You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Susan McPherson is the founder and CEO of McPherson Strategies, a communications consultancy focused on the intersection of brands and social impact. I talked to her about her new book, The Lost Art of Connecting, The Gather, Ask, Do Method for Building Meaningful Relationships. And I think you're going to enjoy the conversation.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Susan McPherson, welcome to the show.
Welcome. I am so excited to be here, truly. Thank you.
So I was in a workshop last week, and I had this aha moment when the person leading the workshop offered that a really good starting place when looking to connect with someone is to ask the question, what do you need? I actually wrote this down and circled it. And then this past weekend, I started reading your book, The Lost Art of Connecting. And right there in the introduction, you write, quote, connecting, as I've come to understand it, comes down to one simple question, how can I help, end quote. So those are very similar sentiments, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This emanates to, you say very early in the book, and I love this part, that you got a lot of this from your parents. Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell me about them.
Well, growing up in far up north state, up New York State, near north of Albany, and I won't disparage Albany for those listeners, but I got the hell out of Dodge when I could. But in a small town called Latham, I would vie for real estate at the breakfast table because both my parents would be pouring through four of the local newspapers and yesterday's New York Times and the Jewish Advocate or whatever the weekly Jewish paper that was in circulation at the time. And what they would do is they would sit there with scissors or their razor blade and clip and cut and fill envelopes and mail them off to people. So, you know, as age three on, I thought everybody did that. I thought every parent did that. And of course, I carried that on. And come the late 80s, when fax machines came into being, once I could finally figure out how to use them, it was like being a kid in a candy store. I could rip an article, slide it through, and voila, show someone you were thinking of them.
What's very funny about that is I spent a year in upstate New York at Ithaca College, and my parents would cut out Mike Royko's column from the Chicago Tribune and send me all the columns every week by the mail.
Yep.
So that tradition seemed to connect as well in my family. So in the book, when you talk about connecting, you say, quote, first and foremost, connect with yourself. So is this the same idea that, you know, you have to put on your oxygen mask before you can put on someone else's?
Well, absolutely, especially if you are going to truly be able to help people. You have to understand what skills and ways you can be of help. And I talk about your chief differentiating factor. Every single one of us has something that makes us unique. We all know that, and it goes far beyond our DNA. But to be able to find out truly how you can be of service to others and actually truly step up and make a difference, you really have to understand what that difference can be. And I'm of the school, and now that I'm vastly heading into my later years, I have come to the understanding that we all can be of service. We can all help one another. And it doesn't mean having to have millions of dollars.
The other thing that is interesting you talk about in the book, too, is a lot of people talk about authenticity. This is this classic buzzword. But it is crucially important. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of what it doesn't mean and there's a lot of what it does mean. And I think when you talk in the book about openness, curiosity, and inquisitiveness as the essential building blocks of connection. And I think that's when your authentic self is engaging someone else's authentic self, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What are some of the stumbling blocks to that? What are some of the things that get in the way that we don't do that?
We don't listen. We don't pay attention. We're too concerned about perhaps the next person in the room rather than focusing on the individual we're speaking to at hand. Or we are in such a rush to walk away with many rather than a few very, very deep and meaningful. I will just tell you a brief kind of interlude of, I think, where this came from in me. First and foremost, I'm very tiny. I'm probably right now about 94 pounds if I'm soaking wet. But more importantly, my license says I'm 5 foot. I'll leave it at that. Mm-hmm. But when I walk into a room and my entire professional career, and probably even before my professional career started, I would walk in a room and no one would see me. Okay. Mm-hmm. So to engage in a conversation with someone, I learned early on to have someone to actually even want to have a conversation, I had to make it about them. And I don't want it to seem like I was being manipulative, but it's you want someone to talk to you, right? So you learn and you adapt ways to actually make it inviting for someone to want to talk to you. And I learned that if I make it about them and listen and ask the kind of meaningful, deep questions that will get at an answer that actually will give you a roadmap, let's say. That is what I learned early on. And what became apparently clear throughout a 30, 35 year career, it is being able to listen and listen for the important clues that you then can follow up and actually make a difference in someone's life.
This is really interesting because this has come up on the podcast in a number of different ways. We just had Chad Sanders on, who wrote a book called Black Magic, and he contests that all the trials and tribulations that Black people go through gives them a sort of special superpower if they can learn to use that and frame that. And then social scientists have tons of research, and Dacre Keltner, I think, was the first one to tell me about this, around the fact that poor people often understand what's really going on more than rich people because they have to.
Mm-hmm. Survival.
Yeah, and it strikes me too as being a small person. that was something for you that you really probably, you know, were you stood out in, you know, in the opposite sort of way. But that's also one of the fonts of your abilities now to have harnessed all this work to see other people and to connect them and then connect with others.
Well, and to be seen, right? Right. I also got a D in conduct when I was in fifth grade, which I thought meant my life was over and ruined and I would never get into college or anything else. But I now realize that was me trying to be seen.
Hmm. So in improvisation, especially in the early classes, they're a lot about listening, as we talked about, but they're also about teaching people to be others focused. You know, there's if you, you know, the thing about improvisation, and really it's just any human being interaction, is we so much are thinking about ourselves, we get caught in our heads, and that's where we screw up all the other time. But everyone's doing that. So the fact if you can just not do it and be others focused, that is an incredible way to start a conversation and a relationship. And I think a lot of your work speaks to that as well.
Absolutely.
you write in the book, quote, "The other big mistake I see people make is becoming married to their shoulds." What do you mean by that?
Exactly what it states. We are conditioned to always do the things that we are supposed to do, that we have been conditioned to do. And what I have learned, what makes life magical is taking the other roads, taking the going a different route, opening that door and actually not knowing what's on the other side, not taking the should.
And is that's maybe what you're getting at when you talk about disrupting your location?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is this idea of making yourself comfortable with being uncomfortable, correct?
Right. I mean, I don't know about you, but as I've gotten older, everyone's uncomfortable. Yeah. I think there's a realization once you realize that you become comfortable because you realize that everyone, I mean, and I know I talk about this in the book, that when you walk in a room and you're terrified because you don't know anyone, the first thing you can do is walk up and talk to the other person who's standing by his or herself. Because guess what? Unless that person is a complete creep, she or he or they are going to be so thrilled that you came up and started to talk to them because they are no longer going to be alone. And it was when I got over that fear that all of a sudden it became less intimidating walking into these conference rooms, boardrooms, convention halls.
We had a social scientist on the podcast a couple months ago, and she actually did a study because she's an introvert and she hates going to those conferences.
Yeah.
But her study revealed that when you walk into those rooms and see those people in the conversations, join the groups that have odd numbers because someone is being left out of the conversation.
I love that. I need to include that. Yes. I need that in my epilogue.
Not that we can do it now, but when I'm actually very excited when the whole conference thing resumes to try that out and see.
Yeah.
But actually, it makes sense when you think about it. One person.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, you can do that in breakout rooms in Zoom meetings.
Yeah.
And I host a lot of events even now in quarantine, and I get almost apoplectic when someone gets left out. It's like I feel nervous for them.
You write in the book, acknowledge everyone in the room. I was on a call the other day where one person wasn't acknowledged. I could not stop thinking about it for the entire meeting.
Yes. Well, I always, you know, I go back to elementary school where, you know, that one person who was sitting by himself at a table, I would always go over and sit and I don't know. It was the I should have been a nurse taking care of people.
Well, let's talk about the world we're living on in Zoom, because I certainly believe Zoom fatigue is a real thing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, and because we do a lot of our workshops using this technology, there's other sort of magic that is happening in these sort of online settings, whether it's the equity in terms of people having access that they've never had before, a global reach and being able to talk to many different people at many different intersections. So you come out fairly positive about these technological worlds we're in.
Well, I think maybe because we know it's not forever. I have to say, I almost feel we're not over the hump or the hill yet, but we are just at the cusp because the vaccines are coming. And I thank God, I'm not a religious person, but the proverbial God, that we have this technology, because I can only imagine what it must have been like in the pandemic of 1918, right? I mean, or in previous times where people couldn't get out and actually physically be together. But I do think that it has leveled the playing field, and it has given you access to things that perhaps you never would have. I mean, I joke, I had a birthday celebration this past year, and I said it was as well attended as my funeral probably will be. Mm-hmm. Because everybody, I had friends from Australia, I had friends from Europe, and we could all do the kumbaya. I mean, of course, I won't be at my funeral, but
it will be in a manner of speaking.
Yeah. But I do think it is important, like you just mentioned. I mean, there does need to be that acknowledgement of everyone. And I call them dangling participles if someone is being hang out. And just like in a human, in a physical world, you can bring people in and you can make sure that you you ask, constantly be asking people questions to keep people engaged. And that is kind of what I talk about in the book is I even have a chapter, which is like the 10 questions you can ask people to actually get beyond the typical niceties. And I'm sure in your improv work, that's what you do quite a bit.
Oh yeah, all the time. And the work we've done at the University of Chicago, one of the studies we worked on, you know, shows that people are often reluctant to share information about themselves, thinking that other people don't care, when the exact opposite is true. The exact opposite is true. You know, people don't mind. Most people don't mind talking to strangers. You know, and yet we're very reluctant to do those things. And we actually built out exercises where you share, you know, unique things about yourself that you do in just banal settings, and that even that alone will connect people more quickly.
Amazing.
Yeah. You talk about Allison Gellis, who did the Renaissance Weekend.
Yeah.
Can you tell that? I'd never heard about that. Tell us about that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, she's a remarkable human. And she, you know, when she... When I first told her about my book, she was like, that is what the Renaissance Festival was always was about, was bringing people together from all walks of life that normally wouldn't have the opportunity to actually meet, and giving them the open space from which to do, and encouraging these kind of conversations, putting people in all sorts of situations, which again makes me think of your you know, improv, but literally making it comfortable, like making it just actually feel as if you've known these people forever, yet one might be a, you know, an Air Force pilot, and another might be a comedian who has performed at Second City. You know, I mean, it's that kind of unique environment. And people come back year after year after year. So I just love it because she is, part of her role is bringing all these people together.
Yeah, I mean, it's the irony of having this conversation right now. Of course, we know this is important. We know this is scientifically based. And yet we're at a time when the nation has never felt more like we're all blocking each other.
Yep.
Literally and figuratively. And, you know, you strike me as an optimist.
Unfortunately.
I wonder about, you know, in this time and place that we're sitting right now, what gives you the optimism that we can connect finally as human beings in this country, especially?
Well, I'm the daughter of a history professor who, so my entire life has always been cloaked in, we learn from what has happened in the past, and then we also know we get through things, and that we are extraordinarily strong individuals. And I do fundamentally, regardless of just the horror show we've seen this past week, and what we've seen through just all sorts of just tragedies that have played out in real time in the past year and beyond, we know that there's good in people. And I don't know. I just fervently believe that. You know, I unfortunately lost my mother to a horrible tragedy when I was young. And something I learned from that was the worst has happened.
Mm.
And I tend to sometimes think, yes, if this, of course, I mean, the fact that we're able to have this conversation and we have food on the table and we're healthy, you know, we aren't at the worst. But as bad as this is, we're through it. We're living it. We're finding ways, and we'll get through it. So I guess that somehow keeps me optimistic. And just being able to keep in touch with people keeps me thriving and feeling positive.
Yeah. I think the other thing that maybe connects this to is where you later talk in the book about thinking of people as a storyboard, which means that they're multidimensional and they change. Which means if you abhor an opinion, why not work on it to change that opinion?
Right. Well, and I'll be honest with you, that's what sometimes frightens me about cancel culture. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, I understand, and people do need to be canceled, you know, when they're egregious and horrible and harmful. Pardon?
Or held accountable.
Held accountable, yes. I think that is a much better way to say it. But I also think we have to look at people's lives in their totality. And we need to take the whole human and know that as we are all filled with faults, every single one of us. If you have met a perfect person, sign me up, because I want to find out their secret. But yes, and it is our faults and our goodness that makes us unique and special.
And you do even talk in the book too about these biases, and you quote Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt, who says, quote, "At its root, bias is not an affliction that can be cured or banished. It's a human condition that we have to understand and deal with, because people aren't good or bad. People do good things or bad things. And if you don't have context," I was listening to Ezra Klein podcast this morning, and this woman, he asked the question, if a tree falls in the woods, can you hear it? And her answer was no, because you need the presence of a human ear and context. And I found that very interesting of like, yeah, because you'd need to even understand what a tree falling would be to understand what that, yeah. Right. So these are just what make us intrinsically human. And I think, you know, to your point throughout the book, it is constantly this tug between, like, you know, embrace your failures and your faults and do that with others. And this is the way you build those kinds of rich relationships.
Well, it also is what makes life fun, quite frankly. I mean, if every single person was the same and we all communicated in the same way and we all connected in the same way, God help us. What a dull life that would be.
I always say to people, too, like, the worst stories are where everything goes well. The best stories are utter fiascos. That is what I want to hear. Tell me your fiasco.
Yes. Well, I mean, and I think that's why we talk about our health. Like, we talk about things that are just plain crazy sometimes, just because they're more interesting.
Mm-hmm. I did love in the book that you bring up comedy, and you say, quote, "What comics do effectively is to read people, especially their energy and that of a crowd." My wife, who is actually a professor of comedy at Columbia College here in Chicago, and I've talked about this a bunch on the podcast, she talks about what stand-up comics do, which is perspective giving, whereas improv comics do perspective taking. We'll take suggestions from the audience and do that. But stand-ups have to sort of present themselves. And that's why if you look at the beginning of a stand-up's career, or their first 5 minutes, it's usually all self-deprecating comments about themselves.
You know, that is so true. I have to say, you know, there's not a lot I'm terrified of, but getting up and doing comedy on stage would be, to me, the most frightening thing in the world.
Comedy is hard, but the what we teach is it takes practice. And this is all over your book. You know, this is not all the stuff that we're talking about just doesn't happen by magic. You have to practice it. You have to put yourself in these uncomfortable positions. You have to try out what it feels like to share, you know, parts of yourself. All that stuff. And so with all the great comic performers that you know, were not good at the beginning. And they just got better and better over time and practicing, and obviously some natural skill as well went in there. But it really is that skill combined with the practice.
Right.
And you talk in the do section of the book.
Yes.
About creating rituals.
Yes.
And we had on Casper Derek Kwai, who wrote a whole book on setting up rituals for himself in his life. But talk to us a little bit about how you see that working in even a business context.
Well, I mean, right now, for instance, rituals, I think, are so vitally important so that people just have something to, like, hold themselves steady and hold each other accountable. And we all know in this kind of Zoom land, Google Hangouts land, it's really hard to get personal with each other and to get personal with our colleagues and feel aligned. And rituals actually do that. And I, you know, with my team at my company, I mean, we're small with 9 people, but what I found at the beginning of the pandemic, it was always like happy hour, and it was getting together with happy hour, which I found like we didn't gain from anything. So mm-hmm. The rituals now that we have taken forth are things like now each every other week, someone has to come up with something unique and interesting to bring everyone together. And we've done everything from, you know, game nights to cooking nights to actually all of us going on walks and hosting the Zoom from all different places. We've also done a ritual where each of us is in a different room or a different area of our home, just to give each other a sense of what each other's lives are like. Now, again, these aren't rituals that we would do over and over again, but it's the ritual of coming up with a ritual.
Yeah. My neighbor is teaches math in an underserved portion of Chicago. And we had this day where we were told that our power was going to go out for a while, and he's teaching from home. So he went to the car and he had the thing up, and they were like, "Where are you?" And he's like, "I'm in the car," and he teaches math, and he's like, "Oh wait, let's do math by me driving around." And they were counting things, or there's how many miles, and he basically figured out that he's going to do that like every Friday as a new way to engage and get the kids excited because they loved it. And I mean, isn't that great?
I love that. Well, and also as someone who always failed at math and later in life realized if someone had taught me why I was learning calculus and what it would benefit me, like if there were practical ways of using that, I would have probably loved it and probably thrived at it.
I feel the same way. I was never good at math, but I was a musician. I played guitar. And then when I figured out that music was math, I'm like, oh, that would have been.
Yeah, like. Ding dong, right? Like if we had done cooking in chemistry, I mean, I would have done so much better.
Another thing you say in the section is practice expertise amnesia. And I think this ties to a thing where you know, if people say, I do a lot of, I'm on a lot of panels, and I often get asked, you know, what is the biggest thing that's standing in the way of innovation? And I usually say success. Because once you've had that success, you tend to just repeat that success and not sort of figure out the ways that you get new successes. So talk to us about how you experience this practicing expertise amnesia.
Well, we have to get out of our own heads. We have to, if we're only doing the same thing over and over again, nothing changes, and then we can't be of value to other individuals. I mean, I just have seen it over and over and over again.
Last thing in the section I want you to talk about is, quote, always take the meeting.
Well, that is honestly, I'll tell you a secret. I founded my company close to 8 years ago, and 98% of our business has been inbound. And I honestly credit it for what I credit that to is the fact that since my early 20s, when someone asked to meet with me and do the proverbial pick my brain, and we all know we hate that terminology, and that terminology has had various different ways of saying it over the years, but I always took those meetings. And, you know, in Adam Grant's first book that he put out, he quoted that actually taking all those meetings makes you more efficient. I 100% concur. And every one of those meetings taught me something. And I also fervently believe that I got to where I was because of all the people that gave me meetings. So it is very much passing on and continuing to give it forward. So I realize some people, it will look at that and be like, I don't have time. There's no way I can do that. I should be paid for my time. I'm not suggesting you go and you give out everything and not be compensated. But I do fervently believe that we all get to where we get because people help us along the way. So I just, that is the ethos that I have lived by and I continue to live by. And I do credit the success in the proof in the pudding. I mean,
many years ago, Adam Grant interviewed me for, I didn't end up in the book, but he wanted to know about improv and comedy. And we of course, stayed in touch because that's what you do when you know Adam Grant. And I had just left the University of Chicago for one of our sessions with the Second Science Project. And I got a call from Adam because he had a friend who was moving to Chicago. Her name was Ai Jen Poo, and he asked if I'd have lunch with her. And I'm like, sure. And I didn't know who she was. I actually didn't even research it. Because I was very busy at the time. But that lunch just changed my life. And Ai Jen became one of my best friends, and we co-built an improvisation for caregivers program. And it was, I took the call and I took the lunch. And you know, you rarely
don't know what you don't know.
Say what?
You don't know what you don't know.
And regret is rarely about like taking the meeting.
Yeah. You know? No. Well, and one of the stories I share in the book it's something that I'm so, so remarkably proud of and humbled by. A friend of mine asked me to help another friend of hers who at the time I thought was a documentary filmmaker, get into a refugee camp in Greece. And just a side note, one of the boards I serve on is the U.S. arm of the U.N. High Commission for Refugees. And at the time, I thought to myself, just what the world needs, another film, another documentary film about refugees that no one's going to see. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those days I decided, you know what, I'm going to do this. I'm going to see what I can do. I got the fella into the camp the next day. Later on, a few weeks later, I learned that not only was he a documentary, not only was he a filmmaker, he was a big budget filmmaker and had done a variety of Tom Cruise's films, and that he would go on to not only be a phenomenal philanthropist to help refugee causes, but he gathered on bequest when I connected him to the folks at CARE, the NGO, he and I think it was eight other filmmakers that he gathered went and spent 10 days in a refugee camp on the Syrian border teaching young Syrian youth how to make films telling the stories of what their exodus from Syria had been. So that one phone call that I decided, you know, I'm so busy today. Do I really? Is this going to make a difference? I learned from that day forward. Well, I this was something I learned long before, but it reinforced everything I believed. And he's become a wonderful friend. He's done a film that has gone on to raise millions and millions of dollars to help refugees around the world. And it was all from that phone call.
That's amazing. Okay, the way we end the podcast is we always ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, the worst thing you can do when starting the scene is saying no. Yes doesn't get you very far. You say yes and you affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
I do. I, back in 2013, was given the opportunity to take on two projects and leave employment, full-time employment, which I had had, I shouldn't say full-time, but I had always had a paycheck since I was 15 years old. And this was an opportunity to move on and start consulting. I was 95% no way. I don't know how to consult. I don't know how. Well, I said yes. And I quit on a Friday. And I started. So my yes was I started on a Monday. I didn't even take a week off. And the reason I didn't take a week off in between was because I thought they were going to change their mind. Mm. So my yes was starting my career running a company at the grand old age of 48. And I'm still here today at 56.
I love it. The book is called The Lost Art of Connecting, The Gather, Ask, Do Method for Building Meaningful Relationships. Susan McPherson, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so very much. What a joy. I want to come and join you at Second City.
Oh, we'll do that when we're in the times when we can actually see each other again.
I would love that. I have two colleagues. I have two staff people in Chicago. So
great.
So we're there.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survives 10 million. feet.
Survive.